Side 27. It, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 1011. He looked back over his shoulder and said, "You follow right behind Mummy, Eddie. I'll need you." The light faded to the faintest gray, held that way briefly, and then it was gone and they were out of the blue and into the black. Bill shuffled forward through the stink, feeling that he was almost cutting through it physically, one hand held out before him, part of him expecting that at any moment it would encounter rough hair, and green lamp-like eyes would open in the darkness. The end would come in one hot flare of pain as it walloped his head off his shoulders. The dark was stuffed with sounds, all of them magnified and echoing. He could hear his friend shuffling along behind him, sometimes muttering something. There were gurglings and strange clanking groans. Once a flood of sickeningly warm water washed past and between his legs, wetting him to the thighs and rocking him back on his heels. He felt Eddie clutch frantically at the back of his shirt, and then the small flood slackened. From the end of the line, Richie bellowed with sorry good humor, "I think we'd just been pissed on by the Jolly Green Giant, Bill." Bill could hear water or sewage running in controlled bursts through the network of smaller pipes, which now must be over their heads. He remembered the conversation about Derry's sewers with his father and thought he knew what this pipe must be. It was to handle the overflow that only occurred during heavy rains and during the flood season. The stuff up there would be leaving Derry to be dumped in Torault Stream and the Penobscot River. The city didn't like to pump its shit into the Kanduskeag because it made the canal stink. But all the so-called gray water went into the Kanduskeag, and if there was too much for the regular sewer pipes to handle, there would be a dump-off. Like the one that had just happened. If there had been one, there could be another. He glanced up uneasily, not able to see anything, but knowing that there must be grates in the top arch of the pipe, possibly in the sides as well, and that any moment there might be... He wasn't aware he'd reached the end of the pipe until he fell out of it and staggered forward, pinwheeling his arms in a helpless effort to keep his balance. He fell on his belly into a semi-solid mass about 2 feet below the mouth of the pipe he'd just tumbled out of. Something ran squeaking over his hand. He screamed and sat up, clutching his tingling hand to his chest, aware that a rat had just run over it. He had felt the loathsome, plaited drag of the thing's hairless tail. He tried to stand up and wrapped his head on the new pipe's low ceiling. It was a hard hit, and Bill was driven back to his knees with large red flowers exploding in the darkness before his eyes. "Be careful," he heard himself shouting. His words echoed flatly. "It drops off here. Eddie, where are you?" "Here." One of Eddie's waving hands brushed Bill's nose. "Help me out, Bill. I can't see. It's..." There was a huge watery kerwash. Beverly, Mike, and Richie all screamed in unison. In the daylight, the almost perfect harmony the three of them made would have been funny. Down here in the dark, in the sewers, it was terrifying. Suddenly all of them were tumbling out. Bill clutched Eddie in a bear hug, trying to save his arm. "Oh, Christ, I thought I was going to drown," Richie moaned. "We got doused. Oh, boy, a shit shower. Oh, great. They ought to have a class trip down here sometime, Bill. We could get Mr. Carson to lead it." "And Miss Jimison could give us a health lecture afterward," Ben said in a trembling voice, and they all laughed shrilly. As the laughter was tapering off, Stan suddenly burst into miserable tears. "Don't, man," Richie said, putting a fumbling arm around Stan's sticky shoulders. "You'll get us all crying, man." "I'm all right," Stan said loudly, still crying. "I can stand to be scared, but I hate being dirty like this. I hate not knowing where I am." Do you think any
of the matches are still any good? Bill asked Richie.
"I gave mine to Beth." Bill felt a hand touch his in the darkness and press a folder of matches into it. They felt dry. "I kept them in my armpit," she said. "They might work. You can try them anyway." Bill tore a match out of the folder and struck it. It popped a light and he held it up. His friends were huddled together, wincing at the brief bright flare of light. They were splashed and daubed with ordure, and they all looked very young and very afraid. Behind them, he could see the sewer pipe they had come out of. The pipe they were in now was smaller still. It ran straight in both directions, its floor caked with layers of filthy sediment, and... He drew in a quick hiss and shook the match out as it burned his fingers. He listened and heard the sounds of fast-running water,
dripping water, the occasional gushing roar as the overflow valves worked, sending more sewage into the Kanduskeag, which was now God only knew how far behind them. He didn't hear Henry and the others. Yet. He said quietly,
"There's a dead body on my river right. About 10 feet away from us. I think it might be Patrick?"
Beverly asked, her voice trembling on the edge of hysteria.
"Is it Patrick Hockstetter?"
Yes.
"Do you want me to light another match?"
Eddie said, "You've got to, Bill. If I don't see how the pipe runs, I won't know which way to go."
Bill lit the match. In its glow, they all saw the green, swelled thing that had been Patrick Hockstetter. The corpse grinned at them in the dark with horrid chumminess, but with only half a face. Sewer rats had taken the rest. Patrick's summer school books were scattered around him, bloated to the size of dictionaries in the damp.
"Christ,"
Mike said hoarsely, his eyes wide.
"I hear them again," Beverly said. "Henry and the others."
The acoustics must have carried her voice to them as well. Henry bellowed down the sewer pipe, and for a moment it was as if he was standing right there.
"We'll get you."
"You come on right ahead,"
Richie shouted. His eyes were bright, dancing, febrile.
"Keep coming, Banana Heels. This is just like the YMCA swimming pool down here. Keep..."
Then a shriek of such mad fear and pain came through the pipe that the guttering match fell from Bill's finger and went out. Eddie's arm had curled around him and Bill hugged Eddie back, feeling his body trembling like a wire as Stan Uris packed close to him on the other side. That shriek rose and rose, and then there was an obscene, thick, flapping noise, and the shriek was cut off.
"Something got one of them,"
Mike choked, horrified in the darkness.
"Something, some monster. Bill, we got to get out of here, please."
Bill could hear whoever was left. One or two, with the acoustics it was impossible to tell, stumbling and scrabbling through the sewer pipe toward them.
"Well, which way, Eddie?"
he asked urgently.
"Do you know?"
"Toward the canal?" Eddie asked, shaking in Bill's arms.
"Yes." "To the right, past Patrick."
"Or over him."
Eddie's voice suddenly hardened.
"I don't care that much. He was one of the ones that broke my arm, spit in my face, too."
"Let's go,"
Bill said, looking back at the sewer pipe they had just quitted.
"Single the line. Keep a touch on each other, like before."
He groped forward, dragging his right shoulder along the slimy porcelain surface of the pipe, gritting his teeth, not wanting to step on Patrick or into him. So they crawled farther into the darkness while waters rushed around them and while, outside, the storm walked and talked and brought an early darkness to Derry. A darkness that screamed with wind and stuttered with electric fire and racketed with falling trees that sounded like the death cries of huge prehistoric creatures. 3. It. May, 1985.
Now they were coming again. And while everything had gone much as it had foreseen, something it had not foreseen had returned. That maddening, galling fear, that sense of another.
It hated the fear, would have turned on it and eaten it if it could have. But the fear danced mockingly out of reach, and it could only kill the fear by killing them. Surely there was no need for such fear. They were older now, and their number had been reduced from 7 to 5. 5 was a number of power, but it did not have the mystical, talismanic quality of 7. It was true that its dog's body hadn't been able to kill the librarian, but the librarian would die in the hospital. Later, just before dawn touched the sky, it would send a male nurse with a bad pill habit to finish the librarian once and for all. The writer's woman was now with it. Alive, yet not alive. Her mind had been utterly destroyed by her first sight of it as it really was, with all of its little masks and glamours thrown aside. And all of the glamours were only mirrors, of course, throwing back at the terrified viewer the worst thing in his or her own mind. Heliographing images as a mirror might bounce a reflection of the sun into a wide, unsuspecting eye and stun it to blindness. Now the mind of the writer's wife was with it, in it. Beyond the end of the macroverse, in the darkness beyond the turtle, in the outlands beyond all lands. She was in its eye. She was in its mind. She was in the deadlights. Oh, but the glamours were amusing. Hanlon, for instance. He would not remember, not consciously, but his mother could have told him where the bird he had seen at the ironworks came from. When he was a baby, only 6 months old, his mother had left him sleeping in his cradle in the side yard while she went around back to hang sheets and diapers on the line. His screams had brought her on the run. A large crow had lighted on the edge of the carriage and was pecking at baby Mikey like an evil creature in a nursery tale. He had been screaming in pain and terror, unable to drive away the crow, which had sensed weak prey. She had struck the bird with her fist and driven it off, seen that it had brought blood in two or three places on baby Mikey's arms, and taken him to Dr. Stillwagon for a tetanus shot. A part of Mike had remembered that always. Tiny baby, giant bird. And when it came to Mike, Mike had seen the giant bird again. But when the dog's body husband of the girl from before brought the writer's woman, it had put on no face. It did not dress when it was at home. The dog's body husband had looked once and had dropped dead of shock, his face gray, his eyes filling with the blood that had squirted out of his brain in a dozen places. The writer's woman had put out one powerful, horrified thought. Oh, dear Jesus, it is female. And then all thoughts ceased. She swam in the deadlights. It came down from its place and took care of her physical remains, prepared them for later feeding. Now Audra Denbro hung high up in the middle of things, crisscrossed in silk, her head lolling against the socket of her shoulder, her eyes wide and glazed, her toes pointing down. But there was still power in them, diminished but still there. They had come here as children, and somehow, against all the odds, against all that was supposed to be, all that could be, they had hurt it badly, had almost killed it, had forced it to flee deep into the earth, where it huddled, hurt and hating and trembling in a spreading pool of its own strange blood. So another new thing, if you please. For the first time in its never-ending history, it needed to make a plan. For the first time, it found itself afraid simply to take what it wanted from Derry, its private game preserve. It had always fed well on children. Many adults could be used without knowing they had been used, and it had even fed on a few of the older ones over the years. Adults had their own terrors, and their glands could be tapped, opened so that all the chemicals of fear flooded the body and salted the meat. But their fears were mostly too complex. The fears of children were simpler and usually more powerful. The fears of children could often be summoned up in a single face, and if bait were needed, why, what child did not love a clown? It understood vaguely that these children had somehow turned its own tools against it. That by coincidence, surely not on purpose, surely not guided by the hand of any other, by the bonding of seven extraordinarily imaginative minds, it had been brought into a zone of great danger. Any one of these seven alone would have been its meat and drink, and if they had not happened to come together, it surely would have picked them off one by one, drawn by the quality of their minds, just as a lion might be drawn to one particular waterhole by the scent of zebra. But together they had discovered an alarming secret that even it had not been aware of. That belief has a second edge. If there are 10,000 medieval peasants who create vampires by believing them real, there may be one, probably a child, who will imagine the stake necessary to kill it. But a stake is only stupid wood. The mind is the mallet which drives it home. Yet in the end, it had escaped, had gone deep, and the exhausted, terrified children had elected not to follow it when it was at its most vulnerable. They had elected to believe it dead or dying, and had retreated. It was aware of their oath, and had known they would come back just as a lion knows the zebra will eventually return to the waterhole. It had begun to plan, even as it began to drowse. When it woke, it would be healed, renewed, but their childhoods would be burned away like seven fatty candles. The former power of their imaginations would be muted and weak. They would no longer imagine that there were piranha in the Kenduskeag, or that if you stepped on a crack you might really break your mother's back, or that if you killed a ladybug which lit on your shirt, your house would catch fire that night. Instead, they would believe in insurance. Instead, they would believe in wine with dinner, something nice but not too pretentious, like a Puy Fuisé 83. And let that breathe, waiter, would you? Instead, they would believe that Rolaids consume 47 times their own weight in excess stomach acid. Instead, they would believe in public television, Gary Hart, running to prevent heart attacks, giving up red meat to prevent colon cancer. They would believe in Dr. Ruth when it came to getting well fucked and Jerry Falwell when it came to getting well saved. As each year passed, their dreams would grow smaller. And when it woke, it would call them back, yes, back, because fear was fertile. Its child was rage, and rage cried for revenge. It would call them, and then kill them. Only now that they were coming, the fear had returned. They had grown up, and their imaginations had weakened, but not as much as it had believed. It had felt an ominous, upsetting growth in their power when they joined together, and it had wondered for the first time if it had perhaps made a mistake. But why be gloomy? The die was cast, and not all the omens were bad. The writer was half mad for his wife, and that was good. The writer was the strongest, the one who had somehow trained his mind for this confrontation over all the years. And when the writer was dead with his guts falling out of his body, when their precious Big Bill was dead, the others would be its quickly. It would feed well, and then perhaps it would go deep again and doze for a while. 4. In the tunnels, 4:30 a.m.
Bill!
Richie shouted into the echoing pipe. He was moving as fast as he could, but that wasn't very fast. He remembered that as kids they had walked bent over in this pipe, which led away from the pumping station in the Barrens. He was crawling now, and the pipe seemed impossibly tight. His glasses kept wanting to slide off the end of his nose, and he kept pushing them up again. He could hear Bev and Ben behind him.
Bill!
He bawled again.
Eddie!
I'm here! Eddie's voice floated back.
Where's Bill?
Richie shouted.
Up ahead,
Eddie called. He was very close now, and Richie sensed rather than saw him just ahead.
He wouldn't wait.
Richie's head butted Eddie's leg. A moment later, Bev's head butted Richie's ass.
Bill!
Richie screamed at the top of his voice. The pipe channeled his shout and sent it back at him, hurting his own ears.
Bill, wait for us. We have to go together. Don't you know that?
Faintly echoing, Bill,
Audra! Audra! Where are you?
God damn you, Big Bill, Richie cried softly. His glasses fell off. He cursed, groped for them, and set them, dripping, back on his nose. He pulled in breath and shouted again.
You'll get lost without Eddie, you fucking asshole. Wait up. Wait up for us. You hear me, Bill? Wait up for us, damn it.
There was an agonizing moment of silence. It seemed that no one breathed. All Richie could hear was distant dripping water. The drain was dry this time, except for the occasional stagnant puddle.
Bill!
He ran a trembling hand through his hair and fought the tears.
Come on! Please, man! Wait up! Please!
And fainter still, Bill's voice came back.
I'm waiting.
Thank God for small favors, Richie muttered. He slapped Eddie's can. Go.
I don't know how long I can with just one arm, Eddie said apologetically. Go anyway,
Richie said, and Eddie began crawling again. Bill, looking haggard and almost used up, was waiting for them in the sewer shaft where the three pipes were lined up like lenses on a dead traffic light. There was room enough here for them to stand up.
Over there,
Bill said.
Chris and Belch.
They looked. Beverly moaned, and Ben put an arm around her. The skeleton of Belch Huggins, clad in moldering rags, seemed more or less intact. What remained of Victor was headless. Bill looked across the shaftway and saw a grinning skull.
There it was. The rest of him. Should have left it alone, guys,
Bill thought and shivered. This section of the sewer system had fallen into disuse. Richie thought the reason why was pretty clear. The waste treatment plant had taken over. Sometime during the years when they were all busy learning to shave, to drive, to smoke, to fuck around a little, all that good shit, the Environmental Protection Agency had come into being, and the EPA had decided dumping raw sewage, and even gray water, into rivers and streams was a no-no. So this part of the sewer system had simply moldered, and the bodies of Victor Chris and Belch Huggins had moldered along with it. Like Peter Pan's Wild Boys, Victor and Belch had never grown up. Here were the skeletons of two boys and the shredded remains of T-shirts and jeans that had rotted away to rags. Moss had grown over the warped xylophone of Victor's rib cage and over the eagle on the buckle of his garrison belt.
"Monster got him," Ben said softly. "Do you remember? We heard it happen. Audra's dead."
Bill's voice was mechanical.
"I know it."
"You don't know any such thing,"
Beverly said with such fury that Bill stirred and looked at her.
"All you know for sure is that a lot of other people have died, most of them children."
She walked across to him and stood before him with her hands on her hips. Her face and hands were streaked with grime, her hair matted with dirt. Richie thought she looked absolutely magnificent.
"And you know what did it?"
"I never should have told her where I was going," Bill said.
"Why did I do that? Why did I?"
Her hands pistoned out and seized him by the shirt. Amazed, Richie watched as she shook him.
"No more. You know what we came for? We swore, and we're going to do it.
Do you understand me, Bill? If she's dead, she's dead. But it's not. Now we need you. Do you get it? We need you."
She was crying now.
"So you stand up for us. You stand up for us like before, or none of us are going to get out of here."
He looked at her for a long time without speaking, and Richie found himself thinking, "Come on, Big Bill. Come on, come on." Bill looked around at the rest of them and nodded.
Eddie?
"I'm here, Bill.
Do you still remember which pipe?"
Eddie pointed past Victor and said,
"That's the one.
Looks pretty small, doesn't it?"
Bill nodded again.
"Can you do it with your arm broken?"
"I can for you, Bill."
Bill smiled, the weariest, most terrible smile Richie had ever seen.
"Take us there, Eddie. Let's get it done."
5. In the tunnels. 4:55 a.m. As he crawled, Bill reminded himself of the drop-off at the end of this pipe, but it still surprised him. At one moment his hands were shuffling along the crusted surface of the old pipe. At the next they were skating on air. He pitched forward and rolled instinctively, landing on his shoulder with a painful crunch.
"Be careful," he heard himself shouting. "Here's the hop-off. Eddie? Here."
One of Eddie's waving hands brushed across Bill's forehead.
"Can you help me out?"
He got his arms around Eddie and lifted him out, trying to be careful of the bad arm. Ben came next, then Bev, then Richie.
"You got any mama matches, Richie?"
"I do,"
Beverly said. Bill felt a hand touch his in the darkness and press a folder of matches into it.
"There's only 8 or 10, but Ben's got more, from the room."
Bill said,
"Did you keep them in your armpit, Bev?"
"Not this time," she said,
and put her arms around him in the dark. He hugged her tight, eyes closed, trying to take the comfort she wanted so badly to give. He released her gently and struck a match. The power of memory was great. They all looked at once to their right. What remained of Patrick Hochstetter's body was still there, amid a few lumpy, overgrown things that might have been books. The only real, recognizable thing was a jutting semicircle of teeth, 2 or 3 of them with fillings.
And something nearby.
A gleaming circle barely seen in the match's guttering light. Bill shook the match out and lit another. He picked it up.
"Audra's wedding ring," he said.
His voice was hollow, expressionless. The match went out in his fingers. In the darkness, he put the ring on.
"Bill,"
Richie said hesitantly,
"do you have any idea?"
6. In the tunnels. 2:20 p.m. How long they had been wandering through the tunnels under Derry since they had left the place where Patrick Hochstetter's body was? But Bill was sure he could never find his way back. He kept thinking about what his father had said.
You could wander for weeks.
If Eddie's sense of direction failed them now, they wouldn't need it to kill them. They would wander until they died, or, if they got into the wrong set of pipes, until they were drowned like rats in a rain barrel. But Eddie didn't seem a bit worried. Every now and then he would ask Bill to light one of their diminishing store of matches, look around thoughtfully, and then set off again. He made rights and lefts seemingly at random. Sometimes the pipes were so big Bill could not reach their tops even by stretching his hand up all the way. Sometimes they had to crawl, and once, for 5 horrible minutes, which felt more like 5 hours, they wormed their way along on their bellies. Eddie now leading, the others following with their noses to the heels of the person ahead. The only thing Bill was completely sure of was that they had somehow gotten into a disused section of the dairy sewer system. They had left all the active pipes either far behind or far above. The roar of running water had dimmed to a far-off thunder. These pipes were older, not kiln-fired ceramic, but a crumbly, clay-like stuff that sometimes oozed springs of unpleasant-smelling fluid. The smells of human waste, those ripe, gassy smells that had threatened to suffocate them all, had faded. But they had been replaced by another smell, yellow and ancient, that was worse. Ben thought it was the smell of the mummy. To Eddie, it smelled like the leper. Richie thought it smelled like the world's oldest flannel jacket, now moldering and rotting. A lumberman's jacket. A very big one, big enough for a character like Paul Bunyan, perhaps. To Beverly, it smelled like her father's sock drawer. In Stan Uris, it woke a dreadful memory from his earliest childhood, an oddly Jewish memory in a boy who had only the haziest understanding of his own Jewishness. It smelled like clay mixed with oil and made him think of an eyeless, mouthless demon called the Golem, a clay man that renegade Jews were supposed to have raised in the Middle Ages to save them from the Goyim, who robbed them and raped their women and then sent them packing. Mike thought of the dry smell of feathers in a dead nest. When they finally reached the end of the narrow pipe, they slithered like eels down the curved surface of another, which ran at an oblique angle to the one they had been in, and found they could stand up again. Bill felt the heads of the matches left in the book. 4. His mouth tightened, and he resolved not to tell the others how close they were to the end of their light. Not unless he absolutely had to.
How you guys doing?
They murmured replies, and he nodded in the dark. No panic and no tears since Dan's. That was good. He felt for their hands, and they stood together in the dark that way for a while, both taking and giving from the touch. Bill felt clear exultation in this, a sure sense that they were somehow producing more than the sum of their 7 selves. They had been re-added into a more potent whole. He lit one of the remaining matches, and they saw a narrow tunnel stretching ahead on a downward slant. The top of this pipe was festooned with sagging cobwebs, some water-broken and hanging in shrouds. Looking at them gave Bill an atavistic chill. The floor here was dry, but thick with ancient mold, and what might have been leaves, fungus, or some unimaginable droppings. Farther up he saw a pile of bones and a drift of green rags. They might once have been that stuff they called polished cotton, workman's clothes. Bill imagined some sewer department or water department worker who had gotten lost, wandered down here, and been discovered. The match guttered. He tipped its head downward, wanting the light to last a little longer.
Do you know where we are?
He asked Eddie. Eddie pointed down the slightly crooked bore of the tunnel.
Canal's that way, he said. Less than half a mile, unless this thing turns in a different direction. We're under Upmile Hill right now, I think. But Bill...
The match burned Bill's fingers, and he let it drop. They were in darkness again. Someone, Bill thought it was Beverly, sighed. But before the match had gone out, he had seen the worry on Eddie's face.
What? What is it? When I say we're under Upmile Hill, I mean we're really under it. We've been going down for a long time now. Nobody'd ever put sewer pipe in this deep. When you put a tunnel this deep, you call it a mine shaft.
How deep do you figure we are, Eddie? Richie asked.
Quarter of a mile, Eddie said. Maybe more. Jesus please us, Beverly said. These aren't sewer pipes anyway,
Stan said from behind them.
You can tell by that smell. It's bad, but it's not a sewery smell.
I think I'd rather smell the sewer, Ben said. It smells like... A scream floated down to them, issuing from the mouth of the pipe they had just left, lifting the hair on the nape of Bill's neck. The 7 of them drew together, clutching each other.
Gonna get you, sons of bitches! We're gonna get you!
Henry, Eddie breathed. Oh my God, he's still coming.
I'm not surprised, Richie said. Some people are too stupid to quit. They could hear faint panting, the scrape of shoes, the whisper of cloth.
You!
Kaka, come on, Bill said. They started down the pipe, now walking double except for Mike, who was at the back of the line. Bill and Eddie, Richie and Bev, Ben and Stan.
How far back do you think Henry is?
I couldn't tell, Big Bill, Eddie said. The echoes are bad.
He dropped his voice.
Did you see that pile of bones?
Yes, Bill said, dropping his own voice. There was a tool belt with the clothes. I think it was a water department guy.
I guess so.
How long you think?
I don't know.
Eddie closed his good hand over Bill's arm in the darkness. It was perhaps 15 minutes later when they heard something coming toward them in the dark. Richie stopped, frozen cold all the way through. Suddenly he was 3 years old again. He listened to that squelching, shifting movement, closing in on them, closing, and to the whispering branch-like sounds that accompanied it. And even before Bill struck a match, he knew what it would be.
The eye, he screamed. Christ, it's the crawling eye.
For a moment the others were not sure what they were seeing. Beverly had an impression that her father had found her, even down here, and Eddie had a fleeting vision of Patrick Hockstetter come back to life. Somehow Patrick had flanked them and gotten in front of them. But Richie's cry, Richie's certainty, froze the shape for all of them. They saw what Richie saw. A gigantic eye filled the tunnel. The glassy black pupil, 2 feet across, the iris a muddy russet color. The white was bulgy, membranous, laced with red veins that pulsed steadily. It was a lidless, lashless, gelatinous horror that moved on a bed of raw-looking tentacles. These fumbled over the tunnel's crumbly surface and sank in like fingers, so that the impression given in the glow of Bill's guttering match was of an eye that had somehow grown nightmare fingers which were pulling it along. It stared at them with blank, feverish avarice. The match went out. In the darkness, Bill felt those branch-like tentacles caress his ankles, his shins, but he could not move. His body was frozen solid. He sensed it approaching. He could feel the heat radiating out from it, and he could hear the wet pulse of blood wetting its membranes. He imagined the stickiness he would feel when it touched him, and still he could not scream. Even when fresh tentacles slipped around his waist and hooked themselves into the loops of his jeans and began to drag him forward, he could not scream or struggle. A deadly sleepiness seemed to have suffused his whole body. Beverly felt one of the tentacles slip around the cup of her ear and suddenly draw a noose tight. Pain flared, and she was dragged forward, twisting and moaning, as if an old lady school teacher were giving her an out-of-patience come along to the back of the room, where she would be forced to sit on a stool and wear a dunce cap. Stan and Richie tried to back away, but a forest of unseen tentacles now wavered and whispered about them. Ben put an arm around Beverly and tried to tug her back. She clasped his hands with panicky tightness.
Ben! Ben, it's got me!
No, it don't! Wait! I'll pull!
He pulled with all his might, and Beverly screamed as pain tore through her ear and blood began to flow. A tentacle, dry and hard, scraped over Ben's shirt, paused, then twisted in a painful knot around his shoulder. Bill put out a hand, and it slapped into a gooey, yielding wetness.
The eye! His mind screamed. Oh, God, I got my hand in the eye! Oh, God, oh, dear sweet God, the eye! My hand in the eye!
He began to fight now, but the tentacles drew him forward inexorably. His hand disappeared into that wet, avid heat. His forearm, now his arm was plunged into the eye up to the elbow. At any moment the rest of his body would come against that sticky surface, and he felt that he would go mad in that instant. He fought frantically, chopping at the tentacles with his other hand. Eddie stood like a boy in a dream, hearing the muffled screams and sounds of struggle as his friends were being pulled in. He sensed the tentacles around him, but none had as yet actually landed on him.
Run home,
his mind commanded him quite loudly.
Run home to your mama, Eddie. You can find the way.
Bill screamed in the dark, a high despairing sound that was followed by hideous squishings and slobberings. Eddie's paralysis broke wide open.
It was trying to take Big Bill.
No, Eddie bellowed. It was a full-blown roar. One might never have guessed such a Norse warrior sound could issue from such a thin chest, Eddie Kasbrak's chest, Eddie Kasbrak's lungs, which were, of course, afflicted with the most terrible case of asthma in Derry. He bolted forward, jumping over questing tentacles without seeing them, his broken arm thumping his own chest as it swung back and forth in its soggy cast. He fumbled in his pocket and brought out his aspirator.
Acid, that's what it tastes like. Acid, acid, battery acid.
He collided with Bill Dendro's back and slammed him aside. There was a watery, ripping sound, followed by a low, eager mewling that Eddie did not so much hear with his ears as feel with his mind. He raised the aspirator.
Acid, it's acid if I want it to be, so eat it, eat it, eat.
Battery acid, fuck nuts,
Eddie screamed and triggered off a blast. At the same time, he kicked at the eye. His foot went deep into the jelly of its cornea. There was a gush of hot fluid over his leg. He pulled his foot back, only dimly aware that he had lost his shoe.
Fuck off! Cram it, Sam! Go away, Jose! Get lost! Fuck off!
He felt tentacles touch him, but tentatively. He triggered the aspirator again, coating the eye, and felt heard that mewling again, now a hurt, surprised sound.
Fight it! Eddie raved at the others. It's just a fucking eye! Fight it, you hear me? Fight it, Bill. Kick the shit out of the sucker. Jesus Christ, you fucking pussies, I'm doing the mashed potatoes all over it, and I got a broken arm.
Bill felt his strength return. He ripped his dripping arm out of the eye and then slammed it fist first back in. A moment later, Ben was beside him. He ran into the eye, grunted with surprise and disgust, and then began to rain punches onto its jellied, quivering surface.
Let her go, he yelled. You hear me? Let her go. Get out of here. Get out of here. Just an eye. Just a fucking eye.
Eddie was screaming deliriously. He triggered his aspirator again and felt it draw back. The tentacles which had settled on him now dropped away.
Richie, Richie, get it. It's just an eye.
Richie stumbled forward, unable to believe he was doing this, actually approaching the worst, most terrible monster in the world.
But he was.
He only threw a single weak punch, and the feel of his fist sinking into the eye, it was thick and wet and somehow gristly, made him throw his guts up in one big tasteless convulsion. A sound came out of him,
glurt,
and the thought that he'd actually puked on the eye caused him to do it again. It was only a single punch, but since he had created this particular monster, perhaps that was all that was necessary. Suddenly the tentacles were gone. They could hear it withdrawing. And then the only sounds were Eddie panting and Beverly crying softly, one hand to her bleeding ear. Bill struck one of their three remaining matches, and they stared at each other with dazed, shocked faces. Bill's left arm was running with a thick, cloudy goo that looked like a mixture of partially congealed egg white and snot. Blood was trickling slowly down the side of Beverly's neck, and there was a fresh cut on Ben's cheek. Richie slowly pushed his glasses up on his nose.
Are we all right?
Bill asked hoarsely. Are you Bill? Richie asked.
Yeah.
He turned to Eddie and hugged the smaller boy with fierce intensity.
You saved my life, man.
It ate your shoe, Beverly said, and uttered a wild laugh.
Isn't that too bad? I'll buy you a new pair of kids when we get out of here, Richie said.
He clapped Eddie on the back in the dark.
How did you do it, Eddie?
Shot it with my aspirator. Pretended it was acid. That's how it tastes after a while if I'm having, you know, a bad day.
Worked great. I'm doing the mashed potatoes all over it, and I got a broken arm,
Richie said and giggled madly.
Not too shabby, Eds. Actually, pretty chuckalicious, tell you what.
I hate it when you call me Eds.
I know, Richie said, hugging him tightly. But somebody has to toughen you up, Eds. When you stop leading the sheltered existence of a child and grow up, you gonna... I say you gonna find out life ain't always this easy, boy.
Eddie began to shriek with laughter.
That's the shittiest voice I ever heard, Richie.
Well, keep that aspirator thing handy, Beverly said. We might need it again.
You didn't see it anywhere, Mike asked, when you lit the match?
It's gone, Bill said, and then added grimly,
but we're getting close to it, to the place where it stays, and I think we hurt it that time.
Henry's still coming, Stan said. His voice was low and hoarse.
I can hear him back there.
Then let's move out, Ben said. They did. The tunnel progressed steadily downward, and that smell, that low, wild stench, grew steadily stronger.
At times they could hear Henry behind them, but now his cries seemed far away and not at all important. There was a feeling in all of them, similar to that feeling of skew and disconnection they had felt in the house on Niebolt Street, that they had progressed over the edge of the world and into some queer nothingness. Bill felt, although he did not have the vocabulary to express what he knew, that they were approaching Derry's dark and ruined heart. It seemed to Mike Hanlon that he could almost feel that heart's diseased, arrhythmic beat. Beverly felt a sense of evil power growing around her, seeming to enfold her, certainly trying to split her off from the others and make her alone. Nervously, she reached out on either side of herself and clasped Bill's hand and Ben's. It seemed to her that if she had to reach too far, and she called out nervously, "Hang on to hands, it's like we're moving away from each other." It was Stan who first realized he could see again. There was a low, strange radiance in the air. At first he could only see hands, his clasping Ben's on one side and Mike's on the other. Then he realized he could see the buttons on Richie's muddy shirt and the Captain Midnight ring. Just some junky cereal box prize that Eddie liked to wear on his little finger. "Can you guys see?" Stan asked, coming to a stop. The others stopped, too. Bill looked around, first aware that he could see, a little anyway, and that the tunnel had widened out amazingly. They were now in a curved chamber easily as big as the Sumner Tunnel in Boston. Bigger, he amended, as he looked around with a growing sense of awe. They craned their necks back to see the ceiling, which was now 50 feet or more above them, and held up by out-curving buttresses of stone-like ribs. Nets of dirty cobweb hung between them. The floor was now stone-flagged, but overlaid with such a drift of ancient dirt that the quality of their footfalls had never changed. The upcurving walls were easily 50 feet away on either side. "Waterworks must have really gone crazy down here," Richie said, and laughed uneasily. "Looks like a cathedral," Beverly said softly. "Where's the light coming from?" Ben wanted to know. "Coming right out of the walls, looks like," Bill said. "I don't like it," Stan said. "Let's go. Henry will be breathing down our necks." A loud braying cry split the gloom, and then the ruffling, heavy thunder of wings. A shape came cruising out of the dark, one eye glaring. The other was a dark lamp. "The bird!" Stan screamed. "Look out, it's the bird!" It dived at them like an obscene fighter plane, its plated orange beak opening and closing to reveal the pink inner lining of its mouth, plush as a satin pillow in a coffin. It went straight for Eddie. Its beak raked his shoulder, and he felt pain sink into his flesh like acid. Blood flowed down his chest. He cried out as the backwash of its beating wings blew noxious tunnel air in his face. It wheeled back, its eye glaring malevolently, rolling in its socket, blurring only as its nictitating eyelid jittered down momentarily to cover the eye with tissue-thin film. Its claws sought Eddie, who ducked, screaming. They razored through the back of his shirt, cutting it open, drawing shallow scarlet lines along his shoulder blades. Eddie yelled and tried to crawl away, but the bird wheeled back again. Mike broke forward, digging in his pocket. He came out with a one-blade buck knife. As the bird dived on Eddie again, he swept it in a quick, tight arc across one of the bird's talons. It cut deep and blood poured out. The bird banked away and then came back, folding its wings, diving in like a bullet. Mike fell to one side at the last moment, slashing upward with the buck knife. He missed, and the bird's claw hit his wrist with such force that his hand went numb and tingly. The bruise that later bloomed there went most of the way to his elbow. The buck flew into the dark. The bird came back, screeching triumphantly, and Mike rolled his body over Eddie's and waited for the worst. Stan walked forward toward the two boys huddled on the floor as the bird returned. He stood, small and somehow trim in spite of the dirt grimed into his hands and arms and pants and shirt, and suddenly held his hands out in a curious gesture, palms up, fingers down. The bird uttered another squawk and sheered off, bulleting by Stan, missing him by inches, lifting his hair and then dropping it in the buffeting wake of its passage. He turned in a tight circle to face its return. "I believe in scarlet tanagers, even though I never saw one," he said in a high, clear voice. The bird screamed and banked away as if he'd shot at it. "Same with vultures and the New Guinea mudlark and the flamingos of Brazil." The bird screamed, circled, and suddenly flew on up the tunnel, squawking. "I believe in the golden bald eagle,"
Stan screamed after it.
And I think there really might be a phoenix somewhere. But I don't believe in you, so get the fuck out of here. Get out. Hit the road, Jack.
He stopped then, and the silence seemed very large. Bill, Ben, and Beverly went to Mike and Eddie. They helped Eddie to his feet, and Bill looked at the cuts.
Not deep, he said, but I bet they hurt like hell.
It tore my shirt to pieces, Big Bill.
Eddie's cheeks glistened with tears, and he was wheezing again. The bellowing barbarian's voice was gone. It was hard to believe it had ever been there.
What am I going to tell my mom?
Bill smiled a little.
Why don't we worry about that when we get out of here?
Give yourself a blahasta, Eddie.
Eddie did, inhaling deeply and then wheezing.
That was great, man, Richie told Stan. That was just frockin' great.
Stan was shivering all over.
There's no bird like that, that's all. There never has been, and there never will be.
We're coming!
Henry screamed from behind them. His voice was utterly demented. He was laughing and howling now. He sounded like something that has crawled out of a crack in the roof of hell.
Me and Belch, we're coming, and we'll get you, little punks. You can't get away.
Bill shouted,
Get out, Henry, while there's still time.
Henry's response was a hollow, inarticulate scream. They heard a hustle of footsteps, and in a burst of comprehension, Bill understood Henry's whole purpose. He was real. He was mortal. He could not be stopped by an aspirator or a bird book. Magic would not work on Henry. He was too stupid.
Come on. We gotta stay ahead of him.
They went on again, holding hands, Eddie's tattered shirt flapping behind him. The light grew brighter, the tunnel ever huger. As it canted downward, the ceiling flew away above until they could barely see it. It now seemed to them that they were not walking in a tunnel at all, but making their way through a titanic underground courtyard, the approach to some cyclopean castle. The light from the walls had become a running green-yellow fire. The smell was stronger, and they began to pick up a vibration that might have been real or might have been only in their minds. It was steady and rhythmic. It was a heartbeat.
It ends up ahead, Beverly cried. Look, it's a blank wall.
But as they drew closer, ant-like now, on this great floor of dirty stone blocks, each block bigger than Basie Park, it seemed, they saw that the wall was not entirely blank after all. It was broken by a single door. And although the wall itself towered hundreds of feet above them, the door was very small. It was no more than 3 feet high, a door of the sort you might see in a fairy tale book, made of stout oaken boards bound with iron strips in an X pattern. It was, they all realized at once, a door made only for children. Ghostly, in his mind, Ben heard the librarian reading to the little ones,
Who is that trip-trapping upon my bridge?
The children leaned forward, all the old fascination glistening in their eyes. Will the monster be bested, or will it feed? There was a mark on the door, and heaped at its foot was a pile of bones. Small bones. The bones of God alone knew how many children. They had come to the place of it. The mark on the door, then.
What was that?
Bill marked it as a paper boat.
Stan saw it as a bird rising toward the sky, a phoenix, perhaps. Michael saw a hooded face, that of crazy Butch Bowers, perhaps, if it could only be seen.
Richie saw two eyes behind a pair of spectacles.
Beverly saw a hand doubled up into a fist.
Eddie believed it to be the face of the leper, all sunken eyes and wrinkled, snarling mouth. All disease, all sickness was stamped into that face.
Ben Hanscom saw a tattered pile of wrappings and seemed to smell old, sour spices. Later, arriving at that same door with Belch's screams still echoing in his ears, alone at the end of it, Henry Bowers would see it as the moon, full, ripe, and black.
I'm scared, Bill,
Ben said in a wavering voice. Do we have to? Bill towed the bones and suddenly scattered them in a powdery, rattling drift with one foot. He was scared, too. But there was George to consider,
It had ripped off George's arm. Were those small and fragile bones among these? Yes, of course they were. They were here for the owners of the bones, George and all the others, those who had been brought here, those who might be brought here, those who had been left in other places simply to rot. We have to, Bill said.
What if it's locked? Beverly asked in a small voice.
It's not locked, Bill said, and then told her what he knew from deeper inside.
Places like this are never locked.
He placed the tented fingers of his right hand on the door and pushed. It swung open on a flood of sick yellow-green light. That zoo smell wafted out at them, incredibly strong, incredibly potent now. One by one, they passed through the fairy tale door and into the lair of it.
Bill.
7. In the tunnels. 4:59 a.m. Stopped so suddenly that the others piled up like freight cars when the engine suddenly comes to a panic stop.
What is it?
Ben called.
It was here. The eye. Do you remember?
I remember, Richie said. Eddie stopped it with his aspirator by pretending it was acid. He said something about some dance. Pretty chuckalicious, but I can't remember exactly what it was.
It doesn't matter. We won't see anything we saw before, Bill said.
He struck a light and looked around at the others. Their faces were luminous in the glow of the match, luminous and mystic. And they seemed very young.
How you guys doing?
We're okay, Big Bill, Eddie said. But his face was drawn with pain. Bill's makeshift splint was coming apart.
How about you?
Oh, okay, Bill said, and shook out the match before his face could tell them any different story.
How did it happen?
Beverly asked him, touching his arm in the dark.
Bill, how could she?
Because I'm henching the name of the town. Shashik came after me.
Even when I was doing it, something inside was telling me to shut up. But I didn't listen.
He shook his head helplessly in the dark.
But even if she came to Derry, I don't understand how she could have gotten down here.
If Henry didn't bring her, then who did?
It, Ben said. It doesn't have to look bad, we know that. It could have shown up and said you were in trouble, taken her here in order to fuck you up, I suppose, to kill our guts. Because that's what you always were, Big Bill. Our guts.
Tom? Beverly said in a low, almost musing voice.
Who?
Bill struck another match. She was looking at him with a kind of desperate honesty.
Tom. My husband. He knew, too. At least I think I mentioned the name of the town to him, the way you mentioned it to Audra. I don't know if it took or not. He was pretty angry with me at the time.
Jesus, what is this, some kind of soap opera where everybody turns up sooner or later?
Richie said.
Not a soap opera, Bill said, sounding sick. A show, like the circus. Bev here went and married Henry Bowers. When she left, why wouldn't he come here? After all, the real Henry did.
No, Beverly said. I didn't marry Henry. I married my father.
If he beat on you, what's the difference? Eddie asked.
Come around me, Bill said. Move in.
They did. Bill reached out to either side and found Eddie's good hand in one of Richie's hands. Soon they stood in a circle, as they had done once before when the number was greater. Eddie felt someone put an arm around his shoulders. The feeling was warm and comforting and deeply familiar. Bill felt the sense of power that he remembered from before, but understood with some desperation that things really had changed. The power was nowhere near as strong. It struggled and flickered like a candle flame in foul air. The darkness seemed thicker and closer to them, more triumphant. And he could smell it.
Down this passageway, he thought, and not so terribly far, is a door with a mark on it. What was behind that door? It's the one thing I still can't remember.
I can remember making my fingers stiff because they wanted to tremble, and I can remember pushing the door open. I can even remember the flood of light that streamed out and how it seemed almost alive, as if it wasn't just light, but fluorescent snakes. I remember the smell, like the monkey house in a big zoo, but even worse. And then, nothing. Do any of you remember what it really was?
No, Eddie said.
I think, Richie began, and then Bill could almost feel him shake his head in the dark.
No.
No, Beverly said.
Uh-uh, that was Ben.
That's the one thing I still can't remember. What it was, or how we fought it.
Chud,
Beverly said. That's how we fought it. But I don't remember what that means.
Stand by, Mimi, Bill said. And I'll just hand by you guys.
Bill, Ben said. His voice was very calm. Something is coming.
Bill listened. He heard dragging, shambling footsteps approaching them in the dark. And he was afraid.
Audra, he called, and knew already that it was not her. Whatever was shambling toward them drew closer. Bill struck a light. 8. Derry, 5 a.m. The first wrong thing happened on that late spring day in 1985, 2 minutes before official sunrise. To understand how wrong it was, one would have to have known two facts that were known to Mike Hanlon, who lay unconscious in the Derry Home Hospital as the sun came up, both concerning the Grace Baptist Church, which had stood on the corner of Wycham and Jackson since 1897. The church was topped with a slender white spire, which was the apotheosis of every Protestant church steeple in New England. There were clock faces on all four sides of the steeple base, and the clock itself had been constructed and shipped from Switzerland in the year 1898. The only one like it stood in the town square of Haven Village, 40 miles away. Stephen Bowie, a timber baron who lived on West Broadway, donated the clock to the town at a cost of some $17,000. Bowie could afford it. He was a devout churchgoer and deacon for 40 years. During several of those later years, he was also president of Derry's Legion of White Decency chapter. In addition, he was known for his devout layman sermons on Mother's Day, which he always referred to reverently as Mother's Sunday. From the time of its installation until May 31, 1985, that clock had faithfully chimed every hour and each half. With one notable exception, on the day of the explosion at the Kitchener Ironworks, it had not chimed the noon hour. Residents believed that the Reverend Jollin had silenced the clock to show that the church was in mourning for the dead children, and Jollin never disabused them of this notion, although it was not true. The clock had simply not chimed. Nor did it chime the hour of 5 on the morning of May 31, 1985. At that moment, all over Derry, old-timers opened their eyes and sat up, disturbed for no reason they could put their fingers on. Medicines were gulped, false teeth put in, pipes and cigars lit. The old folks stood a watch. One of them was Norbert Keene, now in his 90s. He hobbled to the window and looked out at a darkening sky. The weather report the night before had called for clear skies, but his bones told him it was going to rain, and hard. He felt scared, deep inside him. In some obscure way, he felt threatened, as if a poison were working its way relentlessly toward his heart. He thought randomly of the day the Bradley gang had ridden heedlessly into Derry, into the sights of 75 pistols and rifles. That kind of work left a man feeling kind of warm and lazy inside, like everything was somehow confirmed. He couldn't put it any better than that, even to himself. Work like that left a man feeling like he maybe might live forever. And Norbert Keene damn near had. 96 years old come June 24th. And he still walked 3 miles every day. But now he felt scared.
"Those kids,"
he said, looking out his window, unaware he had spoken.
"What is it with them damn kids? What they monkeying around with this time?"
Egbert Thorogood, 99, who had been in the Silver Dollar when Claude Heroux turned up his axe and played the Dead March for four men on it, awoke at the same moment, sat up, and let out a rusty scream that no one heard. He had dreamed of Claude,
Only Claude had been coming after him. And the axe had come down, and a moment after it did, Thorogood had seen his own severed hand twitching and curling on the counter.
Something wrong,
he thought in his muddy way, frightened and shaking all over in his pea-stained long johns.
Something dreadful wrong.
Dave Gardner, who had discovered George Denbrough's mutilated body in October of 1957, and whose son had discovered the first victim of this new cycle earlier in the spring, opened his eyes on the stroke of five and thought, even before looking at the clock on the bureau,
Grace Church clock didn't chime the hour. What's wrong?
He felt a large, ill-defined fright. Dave had prospered over the years. In 1965, he had purchased the Shoeboat, and now there was a second Shoeboat at the Derry Mall and a third up in Bangor. Suddenly, all of those things, things he had spent his life working for, seemed in jeopardy.
From what?
He cried to himself, looking at his sleeping wife.
From what? Why are you so goddamn antsy just because that clock didn't chime?
But there was no answer. He got up and went to the window, hitching at the waistband of his pajamas. The sky was restless with clouds racing in from the west, and Dave's disquiet grew. For the first time in a very long while, he found himself thinking of the screams that had brought him to his porch 27 years ago to see that writhing figure in the yellow rain slicker. He looked at the approaching clouds and thought,
we're in danger. All of us. Derry.
Chief Andrew Rademacher, who really believed he had tried his best to solve the new string of child murders that had plagued Derry, stood on the porch of his house, thumbs in his Sam Brown belt, looking up at the clouds, and felt the same disquiet.
Something getting ready to happen. Looks like it's going to pour buckets, for one thing. But that's not all.
He shuddered. And as he stood there on his porch, the smell of the bacon his wife was cooking wafting out through the screen door, the first dime-sized drops of rain darkened the sidewalk in front of his pleasant Reynolds Street home, and somewhere just over the horizon from Basie Park, thunder rumbled. Rademacher shivered again.
9. George, 5:01 a.m. Bill held the match up and uttered a long, trembling, despairing screech. It was George wavering up the tunnel toward him. George, still dressed in his blood-spattered yellow rain slicker. One sleeve dangled limp and useless. George's face was white as cheese, and his eyes were shiny silver. They fixed on Bill's own.
My boat!
Georgie's lost voice rose, wavering, in the tunnel.
I can't find it, Bill. I've looked everywhere, and I can't find it, and now I'm dead, and it's your fault, your fault, your fault!
Georgie!
Bill shrieked. He felt his mind tottering, ripping free of its moorings. George stumbled, staggered toward him, and now his one remaining arm rose toward Bill, the white hand at the end of it hooked into a claw. The nails were dirty and grasping.
Your fault!
George whispered and grinned. His teeth were fangs. They opened and closed slowly, like the teeth in a bear trap.
You sent me out, and it's all your fault.
No, Georgie, Bill cried. I didn't. No.
Kill you,
George cried, and a mixture of dog-like sounds came out of that fanged mouth. Yips, yelps, howls, a kind of laughter. Bill could smell him now, could smell George rotting. It was a cellar smell, squirmy, the smell of some final monster standing slumped and yellow-eyed in the corner, waiting to unzip some small boy's guts. George's teeth gnashed together. The sound was like billiard balls clicking off one another. Yellow pus began to leak from his eyes and dribble down his face. And the match went out. Bill felt his friends disappear. They were running, of course they were. They were leaving him alone. They were cutting him off, as his parents had cut him off, because George was right. It was all his fault. Soon he would feel that single hand seize his throat. Soon he would feel those fangs pulling him open. And that would be right. That would be only just. He had sent George out to die, and he had spent his whole adult life writing about the horror of that betrayal. Oh, he had put many faces on it, almost as many faces as it had put on for their benefit. But the monster at the bottom of everything was only George, running out into the receding flood with his paraffin-coated paper boat. Now would come the atonement.
You deserve to die for killing me,
George whispered. He was very close now. Bill closed his eyes.
Then yellow light splashed the tunnel, and he opened them. Richie was holding up a match.
Fight it, Bill, Richie shouted. God's sake, fight it. What are you doing here?
He looked at them, bewildered. They hadn't run after all. How could that be? How could that be after they had seen how foully he had murdered his own brother?
Fight it,
Beverly was screaming. Oh, Bill, fight it. Only you can do this one. Please. George was less than 5 feet away now. He suddenly stuck his tongue out at Bill. It was crawling with white fungoid growths. Bill screamed again.
Kill it, Bill, Eddie shouted. That's not your brother. Kill it while it's small. Kill it now.
George glanced at Eddie, cutting his shiny silver eyes that way for just a moment, and Eddie reeled back and struck the wall as if he had been pushed. Bill stood mesmerized, watching his brother come toward him. George again, after all these years. It was George at the end, as it had been George at the beginning. Oh, yes, and he could hear the creak of George's yellow slicker as George closed the distance. He could hear the jingle of the buckles on his overshoes, and he could smell something like wet leaves, as if underneath the slicker George's body was made of them, as if the feet inside George's galoshes were leaf feet. Yes, a leaf man, that was it, that was George. He was a rotted balloon face and a body made of dead leaves, the kind that sometimes choked the sewers after a flood. Dimly, he heard Beverly shriek.
He thrusts his fists.
Bill, please, Bill.
Against the posts and still insists. We'll look for my boat together, George said.
Thick yellow pus, mock tears rolled down his cheeks. He reached for Bill and his head cocked sideward, his teeth peeling back from those fangs.
He sees the ghosts, he sees the ghosts, he sees... We'll find it,
George said. And Bill could smell its breath, and it was a smell like exploded animals lying on the highway at midnight. As George's mouth yawned, he could see things squirming around inside there.
It's still down here. Everything floats down here. We'll float, Bill. We'll all float.
George's fish-belly hand closed on Bill's neck.
He sees the ghosts. We see the ghosts. They, we, you see the ghosts.
George's contorted face drifted toward Bill's neck.
Float. He thrusts his fists against the posts, Bill cried.
His voice was deeper, hardly his own at all, and in a searing flash of memory, Richie remembered that Bill only stuttered in his own voice. When he pretended to be someone else, he never did. The George thing recoiled, hissing, its hand going to its face in a warding-off gesture.
That's it,
Richie screamed deliriously.
You got it, Bill. Get it, get it, get it. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts, Bill thundered.
He advanced on the George thing.
You're no ghost. George knows I didn't mean for him to die. My folks were wrong. They took it out on me, and that was wrong. Do you hear me?
The George thing abruptly turned, squealing like a rat. It began to run and ripple under the yellow slicker. The slicker itself seemed to be dripping, running in bright blots of yellow. It was losing its shape, becoming amorphous.
He thrusts his fists against the posts, you son of a bitch,
Bill Dendro screamed,
and still insists he sees the ghosts.
He leaped at it, and his fingers snagged in the yellow rain slicker that was no longer a rain slicker. What he grabbed felt like some strange warm taffy that melted under his fingers as soon as he had closed his fist around it. He fell to his knees. Then Richie yelled as the guttering match burned his fingers and they were plunged into darkness again. Bill felt something begin to grow in his chest, something hot and choking and as painful as fiery nettles. He gripped his knees and drew them up to his chin, hoping it would stop the pain or perhaps ease it. He was dimly thankful for the dark, glad that the others couldn't see this agony. He heard a sound escape him, a wavering moan. There was a second, a third.
George, he cried. George, I'm sorry. I never meant for anything bad to happen.
Perhaps there was something else to say, but he could not say it. He was sobbing then, lying on his back with one arm over his eyes, remembering the boat, remembering the steady beat of the rain against his bedroom windows, remembering the medicines and the tissues on the night table, the faint ache of fever in his head and in his body, remembering George, most of all that, remembering George, George in his yellow hooded slicker.
George, I'm sorry, he cried through his tears. I'm sorry, please, I'm sorry.
And then they were around him, his friends, and no one lit a match, and someone held him. He didn't know who, Beverly maybe, or maybe Ben or Richie. They were with him,
and for that little while the darkness was kind. 10. Derry, 5:30 a.m. By 5:30 it was raining hard. The weather forecasters on the Bangor radio stations expressed mild surprise and tendered mild apologies to all the people who had made plans for picnics and outings on the basis of yesterday's forecasts. Tough break, folks. Just one of those odd weather patterns that sometimes developed in the Penobscot Valley with startling suddenness. On WZON, meteorologist Jim Witt described what he called an extraordinarily disciplined low-pressure system. That was putting it mildly. Conditions went from cloudy in Bangor to showery in Hampton to drizzly in Haven to moderate rain in Newport. But in Derry, only 30 miles from downtown Bangor, it was pouring. Travelers on Route 7 found themselves moving through water that was 8 inches deep in places, and beyond the Ruland Farms, a plugged culvert and a dip had covered the highway with so much water that the highway was actually impassable. By 6 that morning, the Derry Highway Patrol had orange detour signs on both sides of the dip. Those who waited under the shelter on Main Street for the first bus of the day to take them to work stood looking over the railing at the canal, where the water was ominously high in its concrete channel. There would be no flood, of course. All agreed on that. The water was still 4 feet below the high water mark of 1977, and there had been no flood that year. But the rain came down with steady pounding persistence, and thunder grumbled in the low clouds. Water ran down Up Mile Hill in streams and roared in the storm drains and sewers. No flood, they agreed, but there was a patina of unease on every face. At 5:45, a power transformer on a pole beside the abandoned Tracker Brothers truck depot exploded in a flash of purple light, spraying twisted chunks of metal onto the shingled roof. One of the flying chunks of metal severed a high-tension wire, which also fell on the roof, spluttering and twisting like a snake, shooting an almost liquid stream of sparks. The roof caught fire in spite of the downpour, and soon the depot was blazing. The power cable tumbled from the roof to the weedy verge that led around to the lot where small boys had once played baseball. The Derry Fire Department rolled for the first time that day at 6:02 a.m. and arrived at Tracker Brothers at 6:09. One of the first firemen off the truck was Kelvin Clark, one of the Clark twins with whom Ben, Beverly, Richie, and Bill had gone to school. His third step away from the truck brought the sole of his leather boot down on the live line. Kelvin was electrocuted almost instantly. His tongue popped out of his mouth and his rubber fireman's coat began to smolder. He smelled like burning tires at the town dump. At 6:05 a.m., residents of Merritt Street in the Old Cape felt something that might have been an underground explosion. Plates fell from shelves and pictures from walls. At 6:06, every toilet on Merritt Street suddenly exploded in a geyser of shit and raw sewage as some unimaginable reversal took place in the pipes which fed the holding tanks of the new waste treatment plant in the Barrens. In some cases, these explosions were strong enough to tear holes in bathroom ceilings. A woman named Ann Stewart was killed when an ancient gear wheel catapulted from her toilet along with a gout of sewage. The gear wheel went through the frosted glass of the shower door and passed through her throat like a terrible bullet as she washed her hair. She was nearly decapitated. The gear wheel was a relic of the Kitchener Ironworks and had found its way into the sewers almost 3/4 of a century before. Another woman was killed when the sudden violent reversal of sewage, driven by expanding methane gases, caused her toilet to explode like a bomb. The unfortunate woman, who was sitting on the john at the time and reading the current Banana Republic catalog, was torn to pieces. At 6:19 a.m., a bolt of lightning struck the so-called Kissing Bridge, which spanned the canal between Basie Park and Derry High School. The splintered pieces were thrown high into the air and then rained down into the swiftly moving canal to be carried away. The wind was rising. At 6:30 a.m., the gauge in the lobby of the courthouse building registered it at just over 15 miles an hour. By 6:45, it had risen to 24 miles an hour. At 6:46 a.m., Mike Hanlon awoke in his room at the Derry Home Hospital. His return to consciousness was a kind of slow dissolve. For a long time, he thought he was dreaming. If so, it was an odd sort of dream. An anxiety dream, his old psych prof Doc Abelson might have called it. There seemed to be no overt reason for the anxiety, but it was there all the same. The plain white room seemed to shriek menace. He gradually realized that he was awake.
The plain white room was a hospital room. Bottles hung over his head, one full of clear liquid, the other a deep, dark red one. Whole blood. He saw a blank TV set bolted to the wall and became aware of the steady sound of rain beating against the window. Mike tried to move his legs. One moved freely, but the other, his right leg, wouldn't move at all. The feeling in that leg was very faint, and he realized it was tightly bandaged. Little by little, it came back. He had settled down to write in his notebook, and Henry Bowers had turned up. A real blast from the past, a golden gasser. There had been a fight, and... Henry. Where had Henry gone? After the others? Mike groped for the call bell. It was draped over the head of the bed, and he had it in his hands when the door opened. A nurse stood there. Two buttons of his white tunic were unbuttoned, and his dark hair was mussed, giving him a rumpled Ben Casey look. He wore a St. Christopher medal around his neck. Even in his soupy, only three-quarters awake state, Mike placed him immediately. In 1958, a 16-year-old girl named Cheryl LaMonica had been killed in Derry, killed by it. The girl had a 14-year-old brother named Mark, and this was him.
Mark, he said weakly, I have to talk to you.
Shh, Mark said. His hand was in his pocket. No talk. He walked into the room, and as he stood at the foot of the bed, Mike saw with a hopeless chill how blank Mark LaMonica's eyes were. His head was slightly cocked, as if hearing distant music. He took his hand out of his pocket. There was a syringe in it.
This will put you to sleep,
Mark said, and began to walk toward the bed. 11. Under the city, 6:49 a.m.
Shh, Bill cried suddenly, although there had been no sound except their own faint footsteps.
Richie struck a light. The walls of the tunnel had moved away, and the five of them seemed very small in the space under the city. They huddled together, and Beverly felt a dreamy sense of déjà vu as she observed the gigantic flagstones on the floor and the hanging nets of cobweb. They were close now. Close.
What do you hear?
She asked Bill, trying to look everywhere as the match in Richie's hand burned down, expecting to see some new surprise come lurching or flying out of the darkness. Rodan, anyone? The alien from that gruesome movie with Sigourney Weaver? A great scuttering rat with orange eyes and silver teeth? But there was nothing, only the dusty smell of the dark, and, far away, the thunder of running water, as if the drains were filling up.
Something wrong, Bill said. Mike.
Mike? Eddie asked.
What about Mike?
I felt it too, Ben said.
Is it... Bill, did he die?
No, Bill said. His eyes were hazy and distant, unemotional. All of his alarm was in his tone and the defensive posture of his body.
He
swallowed. There was a click in his throat. His eyes widened.
Oh, no!
Bill, Beverly cried, alarmed.
Bill, what is it? What?
Grab my hands, Bill screamed.
Quick!
Richie dropped the match and seized one of Bill's hands. Beverly grabbed the other. She groped with her free hand, and Eddie grasped it feebly with the hand at the end of his broken arm. Ben grasped his other hand and completed the circle by holding Richie's hand.
Send him our power,
Bill cried in that same strange, deep voice.
Send him our power, whatever you are. Send him our power, now.
Beverly felt something go out from them and toward Mike. Her head rolled on her shoulders in a kind of ecstasy, and the harsh whistle of Eddie's breathing merged with the headlong thunder of water in the drains. 12.
Now,
Mark LaMonica said in a low voice. He sighed, the sigh of a man who feels orgasm approaching. Mike pushed the call button in his hands again and again. He could hear it ringing at the nurse's station down the hall, but no one came. With a kind of hellish second sight, he understood that the nurses were sitting around down there, reading the morning paper, drinking coffee, hearing his call bell, but not hearing it, hearing, but not responding. They would respond only later, when it was all over, because that was how things worked in Derry. In Derry, some things were better not seen or heard, until they were over. Mike let the call button fall from his hands. Mark bent toward him, the tip of the syringe glittering. His St. Christopher medal swung hypnotically back and forth as he drew the sheet down.
Right there, he whispered, the sternum,
and sighed again.
Mike suddenly felt power wash into him, some primitive power that crammed his body like volts. He stiffened, fingers splaying out as if in a convulsion. His eyes widened. A grunt jerked out of him, and that sense of dreadful paralysis was driven from him as if by a roundhouse slap. His right hand pistoned out toward the night table. There was a plastic pitcher there and a heavy cafeteria-style water glass beside it. His hand closed around the glass. LaMonica sensed the change. That dreamy, pleased light disappeared from his eyes and was replaced by wary confusion. He drew back a bit, and then Mike brought the glass up and smashed it into his face. LaMonica screamed and staggered backward, dropping the syringe. His hands went to his spouting face. Blood ran down his wrists and splashed on his white tunic. The power left as suddenly as it had come. Mike looked dully at the shards of broken glass on the bed, and his hospital Johnny and his own bleeding hand. He heard the quick, light sound of crepe-sole shoes in the hall approaching. "Now they come," he thought. "Oh, yes, now. And after they're gone, who'll show up? Who'll show up next?" As they burst into his room, the nurses who had sat calmly on station as his call bell rang frantically, Mike closed his eyes and prayed for it to be over. He prayed his friends were somewhere under the city. He prayed they were all right. He prayed they would end it. He didn't know exactly who he prayed to, but he prayed nonetheless. 13. Under the city, 6:54 a.m. "He's all right," Bill said presently. Ben didn't know how long they had stood in the darkness holding hands. It seemed to him that he had felt something from them, from their circle, go out and then come back. But he did not know where that thing, if it existed at all, had gone or done. "Are you sure, Big Bill?" Richie asked. Yes. Bill released Richie's hand and Beverly's. "But we have to finish this quick as we can. Come on." They went on, Richie or Bill periodically lighting matches. "We don't have so much as a pea shooter among us," Ben thought. "But that's part of it too, isn't it? Chud. What does that mean? What was it, exactly? What was its final face? And even if we didn't kill it, we hurt it. How did we do that?"
The chamber they walked through, it could no longer be called a tunnel, grew larger and larger. Their footfalls echoed. Ben remembered the smell, that thick zoo smell. He became aware that the matches were no longer necessary. There was light now, light of a sort. A ghastly effulgence that was growing steadily stronger. In that marshy light, his friends all looked like walking corpses. "Wall up ahead, Bill," Eddie said. "I nina know." Ben felt his heart begin to pick up speed. There was a sour taste in his mouth, and his head had begun to ache. He felt slow and frightened. He felt fat.
"The door," Beverly whispered.
Yes, here it was. Once, 27 years before, they had been able to pass through that door by doing no more than ducking their heads. Now they would have to duck walk their way through or crawl on hands and knees. They had grown. Here was final proof, if final proof were needed. The pulse points in Ben's neck and wrists felt hot and bloody. His heart had picked up a light and rapid flutter that was close to arrhythmia.
Pigeon pulse,
he thought randomly and licked his lips. Bright greenish-yellow light flooded out from under the door. It shot through the ornate keyhole in a twisting shaft that looked almost thick enough to cut. The mark was on the door, and again they all saw something different in that strange device. Beverly saw Tom's face. Bill saw Audra's severed head with blank eyes that stared at him in dreadful accusation. Eddie saw a grinning skull poised over two crossed bones, the symbol for poison. Richie saw the bearded face of a degenerate Paul Bunyan, eyes narrowed to killer's slits. And Ben saw Henry Bowers.
"Bill, are we strong enough?" he asked. "Can we do this?" "I don't know," Bill said. "What if it's locked?" Beverly asked in a small voice.
Tom's face mocked her.
"It's not," Bill said. "Places like this are never locked."
He placed the tented fingers of his right hand on the door. He had to bend over to do it, and pushed. It swung open on a flood of sick yellow-green light. That zoo smell wafted out at them. The smell of the past become the present, horribly alive, obscenely vital. Roll, wheel, Bill thought randomly and looked around at them. Then he dropped to his hands and knees. Beverly followed, then Richie, then Eddie. Ben came last, his flesh crawling at the feel of the ancient grit on the floor. He passed through the portal, and as he straightened up in the weird glow of fire crawling up and down the dripping stone walls in snakes of light, the last memory socked home with the force of a psychic battering ram. He cried out, staggering back, one hand going to his head, and his first incoherent thought was, "No wonder Stan committed suicide. Oh, God, I wish I had." He saw the same expressions of stunned horror and dawning realization on the faces of the others as the last key turned in the last lock. Then Beverly was shrieking, clinging to Bill, as it raced down the gossamer curtain of its webbing, a nightmare spider from beyond time and space, a spider from beyond the fevered imaginings of whatever inmates may live in the deepest depths of hell.
"No," Bill thought coldly, "not a spider either. Not really, but this shape isn't one it picked out of our minds. It's just the closest our minds can come to the deadlights, whatever it really is."